supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, today's show is about adversity. And I've got one single thought about adversity. I like to tell people that all of the wisdom I've accumulated in my life begins with the following words. Holy shh. Well, you know, holy. And then I say, this is awful. It's not going to change ever. What now? And it's that question, what now, that opens the door to whatever wisdom I've accumulated in life. That's my wisdom. And now my one thought is out on the table, my head is empty, and I'm looking to my guest Norman Rosenthal to replenish my head over the course of this hour. Norman Rosenthal is an author, psychiatrist, and scientist who grew up in apartheid South Africa. He was also the first to describe winter depression or seasonal affective disorder, and he pioneered light therapy for its treatment. But we're going to focus on his book today, and it's The Gifts of Adversity, Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. Norman Rosenthal, welcome to the show.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
And we'd like to hear from you, of course, your experience with adversity, the pluses and minuses. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Take a look at the adversity you've experienced over your life, but look at it in the rearview mirror. Norman, a very wise woman I know once said that life is the university of adversity. And yet parents, especially today's parents, want to do everything in their power to protect their child from adversity. And those protective instincts can go on for the first 20, 30 years of a child's life.
Well, all I can say is I completely agree with you. On many scores, firstly, that question, what now, often opens doors. Secondly, that life is a university of adversity, like it or not. You don't have to go looking for it. It'll find you. Mm. Thirdly, the idea that sometimes the lessons are best seen in the rearview mirror, because when you're in the middle of adversity, it's very difficult to see any silver linings at all. They're often seen as time passes. And that's really how I came to the title of my book, because it was going to be lessons I'd learned during my life based on things that had happened to me. I did grow up in very interesting times with the apartheid South Africa and just after the end of the Holocaust. So these were huge historical shadows that sort of fell across everybody who lived in those communities. And so I thought, you know, a lot of interesting people I've come across, a lot of interesting things happened to me. Let me write about them and write about the lessons. And as I read through, I thought, holy, to, you know, repeat your phrase, holy heavens, what is this going on over here? It's always adversity that's teaching me. And so anyway, that was a revelation to me, that it's in adversity that we learn our biggest lessons. And so all the stories are seen through that lens, and things just flowed once I had that prism with which to look through to evaluate my life.
So I want to start with that first lesson about growing up in apartheid and what the experience was like for you. We've got a dear friend of the show and a personal friend of mine, Sharon Katz, who was founder of the Peace Train, and she grew up there also, and she was like you, despite being Jewish, she was privileged because she was European. And she suffered because she saw the injustice around her. What was it like for you, Norman?
Well, we were privileged in a way, you know, in that the injustice was not focused on us, as it had been on our grandparents who'd left Eastern Europe for safe harbor, which South Africa had provided them. However, the safe harbor was really confined to people with white skin, and then only if they towed the line very, very carefully. And there was just fear. Everywhere there was fear that if you stepped out of line, you could really fall foul of a very vicious fascist government. And in fact, one of the chapters in my book has a story of a cousin of mine who did some very minor things against the government, really nothing particular that would ever be regarded as bad in this country. And yet he was locked up and tortured in solitary confinement for an extended period. And it was this kind of thing that just drove terror through the hearts of the people not to step out of line.
How old were you when you first experienced this fear?
When I first experienced the fear came along with a bunch of protective mechanisms that parents instilled in their children. So when my wife and I went to South Africa with our child, who was then 3 years old, he ran out of the main house across the courtyard that separated the house from the servants' quarters and ran right into the servants' quarters as though it was simply an extension of the house. Well, we knew you didn't venture in there. It was forbidden territory. And the servants were just delighted that here was somebody who was just treating them like normal people and their rooms just like a normal house. And they said, he is not like a South African child. So you are taught very early to just stay within your confines. So that's how it was back then.
How did that inform your life?
Well, what we did was we just went about our business. We tried to be nice to whoever we could. We tried to be good people. We volunteered to pack food for the hungry. We did odds and ends, but really we made no real difference to the system at all. And at the same time, we sat with a kind of chronic feeling of guilt that not only were we doing much too little and was injustice going on all around, but somehow in living in the country, paying our taxes, even if we voted against the government, we were essentially supporting the system. And I think it led to a sense of chronic unease and guilt.
I've got another friend of mine who grew up in South Africa, and to this day he lives with guilt. And it's that guilt that has informed his life. What about you? What are the benefits that you've taken from that?
Well, several benefits. Firstly, coming to this country, I remember the first time I realized what freedom of speech meant. I was in a diner, and I was talking with my family, and I was telling them something that I disapproved of that the president had done. And all of a sudden, I had this feeling that somebody might be watching me, behind me, and listening and taking notes, and that I could get into terrible trouble. And then I realized, you're in America now. You're not in South Africa anymore. This is a free country. And I understood what being able to say what you want means, and the value of that, the freedom. You don't realize freedom until you don't have it, or if you haven't had it. Likewise, freedom from fear. When I came back from one visit to South Africa where the houses were surrounded by walls and razor wire and electrical fences and so on, and I came back and I walked through the streets of my neighborhood, which don't have any fences at all, and I had no fear, and I understood, yes, you know, that's what Norman Rockwell was painting about, freedom of fear. Freedom of this, freedom of that. You don't know what these freedoms mean if you haven't had them constrained. So that was the value of those adversities. It made me appreciate life much more.
Well, this raises the question then about your book and your presentations and my books and presentations about adversity. Can we learn, can we acquire wisdom through other people's adversity? Or do we have to experience it ourselves?
Well, I hope we can, really. I don't want people to go through all the horrors that one can go through. And, you know, as a psychiatrist treating patients, my hope is that they don't have to go through everything that is possible to go through in order to learn wisdom. And I don't believe that's true. For example, I think, you know, I can empathize with somebody who has one kind of problem, even if I don't have that kind of problem. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I talk about growing up with really serious eye-hand coordination problems and directional problems. That part of my brain that's responsible for hitting a ball with a bat just didn't work. And I just understood the deficit, and nobody else seemed to. They kind of just felt like if they threw the ball at me enough times, you know, it would work, and it didn't. And so now maybe somebody comes in who can't read or who can't spell or who can't pay attention or whatever. You know, there are many, many parts of the brain, and all of them can go wrong. So, you know, I think the fact that I learned that one part of the brain, try as I may, I couldn't really become good at, that helps me understand other people. And so I've used these kinds of personal experiences to reduce the sense of shame, because people feel shame if they feel like they have got some functional deficit. And in fact, everybody's got something they can't do properly. So, you know, what I wanted to do here is to make it normal and okay.
Einstein, one of his famous quotes is, everybody's a genius, but if you expect a fish to climb a tree, it's going to feel like a failure its whole life.
That's a great saying. I love it.
Isn't it wonderful? That's yes. Norman Rosenthal, and we're talking about adversity, and his book is called The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties. Love to hear from you on today's show. We've got a couple of open lines, and we'll be going to the phones pretty soon. Our number is 888-477-9499. What's your experience with adversity? Have you reaped any benefits from your experience of adversity, or no? Is it just suffering and unnecessary suffering? Love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. So, Norman, you talked about the brain thing, and in your book, you talked about knowing your brain and your body. Mm-hmm. Say more. How so?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. It's the old cliche of nobody gives you a user manual. You know, you're just kind of born with this brain and this body, and everybody's brain and body works a little differently, and you're finding, you know, are you an introvert? Do you need quiet, you know, in a country where people are rewarded for being outgoing? Are you socially anxious? Are you whatever, you know? Are you gay? Are you, you know, does your brain work a little differently from somebody else's brain? And whatever it is, the understanding that all of our brains are different, and that on the one hand, you know, you have to kind of get used to it, and you have to get comfortable with it. But on the other hand, it can also be a most amazing gift. Here's an example. We came to the United States. It's far north, whereas we had lived in South Africa. And those 3 winters of my residency in New York, we struggled terribly with what now, of course, we know to be seasonal affective disorder. But then all we knew is we couldn't cope. We were tired. We couldn't get up in the morning. We felt depressed. We felt demoralized. What had happened? We were okay during the summer, and now all hell had broken loose. And we struggled, and we got through, but it was really hard and really painful. And then when I came to the National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda, Maryland, I joined a group that was studying moods and cycles and light, and all the pieces came together that this was a newly identified syndrome, and I called it seasonal affective disorder. And that was really one of the greatest professional gifts that I ever had, because it proved to be a very exciting field and helped a lot of people. And I don't think I would ever have had the conviction to pursue what seemed at that time like a wacky idea had it not been for my personal suffering in those winters and my wife's suffering and watching her struggle and me struggle. It turned out to be a gift. So the point here is that we're all different, and we've all got special features. And one thing is to understand it, but the other thing is maybe you can even use it to your advantage.
Well, I want to add something in here. It's not just knowing your brain and your body, but it's knowing it with acceptance, even compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's and that can take a while. You know, any good relationship takes a while.
It can, and exactly. And I encourage people to enjoy the journey like a long romance. Have this long romance with your brain, with your body. Get to know, there's that song that I quote, you know, it takes a lifetime to say, I knew you well. And, you know, so it's this process of becoming comfortable with who you are. As Oscar Wilde said, be yourself, everyone else is already taken.
Mm-hmm. I love that line. So, Norman, like you, I had adversity in childhood. Like you, I had a learning disability before the world knew anything about learning disabilities. So I began failing in school as early as the fifth grade. Now, when I look back, that disability not only helped my practice, but it helped my writing, it helped my worldview. But as a child, I didn't know that. I suffered with great shame for the first 30 years of my life. And so, you know, there are benefits, and you know, I really suffered with shame for half my life, if not longer.
You know, it's a story, you know, that obviously somebody who listens to feels sad for that little boy and the pain and the shame, and at the same time respect for overcoming these things. But I guess that the word shame is such a simple word. It's like one syllable. It's like pain. But shame is so painful. It's such a painful feeling. It's a feeling that if anybody really knew what was really going on inside my mind, they would really despise me, or they wouldn't want to talk to me, or they would judge me. And oftentimes, these are all exaggerated out of all proportion, but we don't know that. And maybe sometime one does tell somebody something, and then one's worst fear gets confirmed. You tell the wrong person, and they react in a funny way. But my hope is that as people become more understanding of individual difference and of diversity, that shame will decrease. I hope it does. I'm not quite sure what value it really serves.
Well, I've got to tell you what happened with my shame about about my underachievement. My radio audience cured my shame, because it was early on when I first started doing this show, and I was afraid to tell my audience that I got poor grades in school, because mm-hmm. I figured I'd be drummed off the air. But mm-hmm. but I did, and you know, I got all sorts of positive feedback, mm-hmm. and you know, the audience responded with their issues, and like, the more I talked about it, the less shame I felt, and of course,
right.
The more people are like that. So, you know, sunshine cures shame.
That's a brilliant expression. I have one client who is in the business world where it's very deleterious, or so they think, to expose any weakness. You need to present this kind of armored facade, and he would suffer rather bad depressions, and he would become suicidal during the depressions. And then he decided the next time he got depressed, he was going to tell everybody about it. And guess what? He still had his depression, but all the suicidal ideas went. Just the process of letting in that sunshine
sure.
took away the feeling that he had to just get rid of himself, which was a huge discovery and a major relief for everybody concerned. So I completely identify with you on that one.
Yeah, Norman, I don't know if our producer Jennifer Lynn told you that that I'm a quadriplegic, and you know, I wear a catheter that is mostly reliable. So the truth of my life is, you know, sometimes I wet my pants, and I wet my pants in public, and you know, I felt real shame about that at first, and I don't anymore because you do it enough, and you know, it becomes part of your life. And, you know, I came to realize, Norman, everybody pees in their pants, but I'm lucky. You know, I don't have to hide it, and everybody else has the burden of trying to hide it. So, you know, I'm grateful for that. That's in a
well,
way that's
you know,
a gift.
I think to say I'm grateful already, it already is already elevates one. You know, and these bodily functions we have very strong feelings about. And I remember one time I had some kind of an infection, and when I peed, it was really sore. And my wife gave me this prayer, which apparently Orthodox Jews say every day, which, you know, I don't say every day. I never even knew it existed. But it was a wonderful prayer, and it said, you know, thank you for allowing me, or thank you for the fact that I can pee.
Right.
Because the body is full of openings and cavities such that if even one of them is blocked off, it's a pain and a burden and can threaten your life. Because, you know, we go through our daily living without really realizing that all the ordinary things we do are like amazing gifts, and it takes an adversity to really show us that that is in fact the case.
Yeah, Norman, we've got a lot of people who want to join our conversation, so let's take a break and listen to some of the experiences of our audience. Norman Rosenthal's an author, psychiatrist, he's a scientist, and he's written The Gift of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. Our number is 888-477-9499. We'd like to hear about your life. When you look in the rearview mirror of your adversities, what did you learn and what did you need to learn? What opportunities did you miss? 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
One in three families is affected by problems caused by drugs or alcohol. The Family Training Program is a service for those concerned about their child, age 12 to 25, that may be using drugs or drinking. If eligible, you will be invited to sessions with a family specialist to help make positive changes in your life and in the relationship with your child. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More at 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-I-WORRY-2, or online at iamconcerned.org.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host, talking with psychiatrist Norman Rosenthal about the gifts of adversity. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Allison on the line. Hi, Allison.
Hey. Hi, Dan. Thank you so much for taking my call. I wanted to share that I, as a child, my parents went through a really acrimonious divorce, and then I subsequently, you know, my father remarried a severe alcoholic. And so these were really very traumatic experiences for me at a relatively young age. And I said, as early as even in college, that I was grateful for having had those experiences because I felt like I matured. I felt like I learned a lot about what was important and what wasn't important. And subsequently, you know, I have children now, and two of my children had really serious health concerns. And I feel like I was able to cope with those situations better because of the traumatic kind of nature of the experiences I had as a child.
So if you can stay with us for just a minute, Norman, I want you to weigh in here. What's the difference between Allison and someone who lives a lifetime of bitterness or feeling like a victim or just feeling vulnerable? What's the difference?
Well, it's very interesting. Firstly, there is science that shows that some adversity makes you more resilient than if you have no adversity. So that is a scientific study, which has been done experimentally. Secondly, there is this very interesting concept that there are now over 3,000 journal articles on called post-traumatic growth, that some people, when they get traumatized, instead of getting PTSD, which we hear a lot about, they get PTG, post-traumatic growth. And there are several keys to those people who do. They tend to be more optimistic and hopeful, and they find meaning. They find meaning, and their beliefs are altered. Meaning about what is valuable in life, what their purpose in life is, how they're going to carve out good lives for themselves. They somehow take the trauma and turn it into something positive. And it seems to be partly due to their personality. It helps if they've gotten support from friends or family. But I think those people who are bitter can reevaluate the situation and think about having a different adaptation, because it's not a pleasant way to live, to be bitter and angry.
Well, then you carry the trauma with you. Allison, what about those variables that Norman talked about? Were you up? Go on.
I apologize. I would have to agree with that, although I actually also suffer from depression and have done for a long time. But I do agree that that you have kind of two choices about how you want to go about dealing with this trauma. You can either let it kind of destroy you and eat you alive inside, or you can decide, I have to, like, step forward. I have to try and move forward. And so I found that would be what I would be saying to myself. You know, okay, just keep moving. You know, let's keep moving to the next thing. And try and minimize the emotional element of it. I found that even with my parents' behaviors, to this day, I still try to sort of minimize the emotional element of it. And I've learned, fortunately, through therapy, to not take it personally necessarily, to observe these actions by them as their responsibility. Right. They are responsible for their actions. I'm responsible for my actions and my reactions to their actions.
Well,
Allison, that makes any sense.
Allison, I want to thank you so much for your call and all of the important issues that you've learned from your trauma. Thanks so much, and take care. I want to suggest something, Norman. I don't know if I can fairly say you were implying it, and Allison might have mentioned it. Is it simply a choice to not carry your trauma with you?
You know,
I mean, I don't want to make people feel guilty or ashamed because they're suffering.
No, I think it is a choice, but it's much more than that. In my book, The Gift of Adversity, I lay out certain basic principles that will help people with any adversity, accepting that the adversity has occurred. Denial is a costly defense mechanism. Analyzing your situation, analyzing the situation and considering what you can do to make matters better, cultivating good habits. Some people compound adversity, drugs, alcohol, fast foods, to get a quick fix. If you get good habits and live in a healthy way, meditation, that's one
practice transcendental meditation that I talk about that's helped me tremendously through the adversity of a severe writer's block that went on for almost 10 years. And, you know, in the last 3-4 years, I've written several books. And I attribute it to that particular habit of clearing my mind and being more creative. So I really want to say it's not just wake up, make a different choice. There's a lot of actual steps that you can take that will help you to process your adversity. Now, one thing Alison mentioned, which is very important, she turned it into a narrative, she turned it into a story, and then she changed the narrative. Now she started reframing what she saw. It wasn't her fault. They were problematic. Don't take it personally. She began to look at it and alter her way of dealing with it and thinking about it, and that made all the difference. Or, for example, your instance in terms of deciding that people pee in their pants all the time and you don't have to make a big deal out of it. And so I think that there are these cognitive things that come about, but I think you have to really look at the adversity in a very front, full square way and start implementing things that are known to be helpful.
Look at it, meaning taking ownership of it. It's a fact of your life.
Exactly.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Barry on the line. Hi, Barry.
Hi, Dan. My question was partially answered by the last call. I'm a physician who grew up in South Africa, came to America, I presume roughly the same time as your speaker. But I followed the profession of being a practicing physician in private practice, and I found that the fear that I had in South Africa was replaced by perhaps even a greater fear, and that is a fear of litigation, of being sued, fear of bankruptcy, the kind of fears that exist in America. And they were very real, and so the four freedoms he spoke of had not been taken care of in the time since Roosevelt and now. And my concern is that since I've started, you know, mentoring physicians who had the same fear and, like me, were actually sued, that many had post-traumatic stress disorder symptoms and didn't have the ability to cope with the adversity and weren't taking the lessons and particularly were isolated and did not have the healing that came from connection.
And what about
I'm really concerned that people may feel the guilt, as you point out, that they should make meaning of the adversity when they don't, they're not empowered to do so.
Barry, what about you?
Oh, I was never sued. But I lived with the fear for about 40 years.
That's what I'm wondering. Do you still live with that fear?
I actually do, even though I'm not in practice anymore. But I do have occasional nightmares. I do have, and physical effects, you know, pulse racing and that sort of thing that came along with an adverse effect, a reaction, you know, with patients in practice.
And it does feel to you like this began when you started practicing in this country?
Oh, yeah. I think as an immigrant with a lack of support, the isolation, dealing in a high-stress environment, and not knowing when something adversarial can happen, and in this country, it can be pretty catastrophic.
Norman, you want to weigh in here with Barry?
Well, yeah. I really firstly thank you, Barry, for calling. And I think, obviously, this is a very real fear and a very real adversity when it happens. It's one of these civilized adversities, if you like, that in the many countries, they can be less, quote, developed than we are, but they don't worry about, you know, to this extent of lawsuits. I recall a wonderful article I read in the New York Times of an obstetrician who'd delivered a baby, and it turned out that the baby's shoulders got stuck, and that's something you couldn't at that time determine by x-rays and other things, that the shoulders would get stuck. You just didn't, you weren't able to tell. And he had to kind of break the collarbone to get the baby out, and a healthy baby was born. the collarbone was going to get fixed and everything was going to be fine. And was really, he saved the baby's life. But the parents decided they wanted a perfect baby. The baby's collarbone was broken and they sued. The jury, you know, weighed in. The jury rendered a verdict against him. And his conclusion was he just understood that in America, there is the sense that everybody has a right to a perfect baby. And that if you don't get a perfect baby, then you need a consolation prize. And the consolation prize is, you know, a settlement from a lawsuit. Now, I'm not justifying, incidentally, gross malpractice. That's, you know, that's a legitimate basis for suits. But I think what Barry is talking about is often frivolous suits or people who want consolation prizes because things didn't turn out 100%, which that's life. So I think Barry is kind of talking about a real adversity that really exists, but how people process it, I think, still is to some degree a personal issue. And, you know, I'm sorry that it was such a source of fear, and I know that in many people it is, and I've certainly not been immune from that fear. And I don't think any medical people are. I think it needs to be dealt with in an institutional way. But I think it's one example of adversity that maybe we didn't have back in South Africa. So I don't want to pretend that that society was, you know, the worst ever and that this is the best ever. I think we've got problems. The tax audit is another thing that's terribly stressful. People sweep in and you've got to go and find every little paper of this or that or the other. It's like a nightmare. Or a contested divorce with custody problems that go on forever and ever and ever. There are things that are, you could write a book called The Adversities of a Civilized Society, because some of these things are really quite ridiculous. But there you are. That's life.
Barry, I want to thank you for your call. I want to put something in context. You know, I was just in South Africa, and I had the privilege of going to a school, the Kulani Special School, for children with a whole range of disabilities. This school was in Shishui, where, deep in the bush, where there was grinding poverty. And there's about 120 kids there who had nothing. They slept on the floor. Some had blankets, some didn't. Their food was not nutritious. And a range of disabilities, from spinal cord injury to cerebral palsy to autism to intellectual disabilities, the whole range. And it was just sand. I mean, the whole area was just sand. And I saw kids with autism pushing other kids with cerebral palsy in their wheelchair through the sand, and both of them were laughing. And I gave a talk to these kids, and I was surrounded with them after I gave the talk. They were filled with love and happiness. And what a lesson for me that love can be there, that you don't need everything in order to feel love. And when you feel love, you feel safe, regardless of external circumstances. Now, I don't want to minimize the suffering they went through and are living with, and I'm going to make it my business to help however I can. But I was so humbled by the amount of love they carry inside their hearts every day.
Yeah, I think the fact of being loved or of having been loved is tremendously comforting throughout one's whole lives. And, you know, I think that a mother's love and a father's love will equip children for their whole lives with an ability to face the world and feel worthy. And so I think that, you know, it enables you to overcome all kinds of obstacles. And I deal with some of that in the book. I deal with the importance not only of loving, but of telling somebody you love them and sharing that, because those are powerful words for people.
They are, especially when they come from one's heart.
Exactly.
We've got to take a short break, Norman. When we come back, I want to talk with more of our callers, and I want to hear a little bit about your seasonal affective disorder research. We're talking with Norman Rosenthal, who's an author, psychiatrist, scientist. His book is called The Gifts of Adversity, The Unexpected Benefits of Life's Difficulties, Setbacks, and Imperfections. If you want to join the show, our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
Supporting WHYY, researchers at Drexel University are seeking women with bulimia nervosa for a study funded by the National Institutes of Health. Females 18 to 45 who have been binging and purging at least weekly for at least 3 months are eligible. Details at 215-762-1313 or email TEDS, that's TEDS, at drexel.edu. The number again is 215-762-1313. All calls will be kept confidential.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb speaking with psychiatrist Norman Rosenthal about his book, The Gift of Adversity. And we've got Susan on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Dan. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question. You know, I, like most of us, have experienced adversity. And honestly, I continue to thrive and be really hopeful most days. And I will say my parents are similar to that, but not all of my siblings. So my question is positive attitude or hopefulness, I think you used, like genetic or, as we sometimes say, you know, I'm wired that way, or can we learn or teach our kids skills that help them to be that way prior to facing adversity so that they have what they need when it does arrive, and it will.
Well, I think your question's great, and there were two questions, and I can answer them both before we get Norman in there with specifics. The answer to both of your questions, is it wired, can we learn? Yes, is the answer to both of those questions. Norman, you agree?
I do. You know, there's some very interesting studies in rhesus monkeys where they find that a certain percentage, maybe 15% of monkeys, when they're infants, they show great nervousness, they're fearful, they don't venture out. And if they take those monkeys and they have them raised by rhesus mothers who are known to be supermoms, who are just fantastic, they're there for the kids, they're supportive, they're protective, they're loving, they give a lot of attention and contact, those nervous babies grow up to be the leaders of the colony. Somehow they have certain elements of sensitivity or inter-animal skills that when they are given sufficient nurturance and support bring out outstanding qualities. So I agree with Dan on both points, and that's just a little data to back it up.
So what is a mother to do to get specific to Susan's question?
A couple of things. I think to really make a child feel loved and appreciated is important, but I want to circle back to something you said early on, that this total protection from every kind of adversity is not, in my opinion, a good thing. I think that kids should be exposed to a little bit of adversity. What do I mean? Maybe they have to cry for 2 minutes before the parent comes in, instead of being snatched up out of the crib at the very first whimper. Maybe they need to be told when they're a little older, maybe you need to wait 2 minutes. Mom and Dad are busy right now, and we'll be with you in a few minutes. I remember when I was a little boy, for some reason, I was furious at my parents, and I lay on my bed kicking and screaming and yelling, and guess what? Nobody came. And
after about 5 or 10 minutes, I thought, there's no point in doing this anymore. And, you know, I just learned tantrums are not going to get me anywhere. But I think oftentimes the parent who's trying to be extra diligent experiences that as distress, and children should never be distressed, and we should swoop in and stop the screaming right off the bat. And I think the kids don't learn that way. So you can be loved and supported, but at the same time taught that, you know, sometimes life is a little difficult and it's okay.
Susan, thanks so much for your call. It's an important question, and these are important lessons. We need to teach our children to cope with adversity, not to avoid it. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Ellen on the line. Hey, Ellen. Do we have you, Ellen? I guess there's a problem with the line there. We'll get back to Ellen in just a minute. I want to hear about, you said when you were as a psychiatrist, you were most empathic when you were suffering. But doesn't that mean that you're most empathic when your heart is open and when you're close to your own emotions?
I think, you know, to stay fresh in terms of listening to other people's pain, every person that tells you about the pain, it's important to hear it with a full heart. And that's something that it can be hard to do because, you know, you're on a busy day and one person comes in after the other, and it's very, very important not to become hardened or inured. I think that's trouble with these clinics where people are coming in and out in 20 minutes and one after the other, and I don't think it's humanly possible for those people to really, really feel with every single person. But I think what I've noticed is that if there's some difficulty going on in my own life, you would think on the surface that it would make you less equipped to be skillful. But many colleagues have shared this with me, that sometimes when you're at your most empathic, caring, loving, because the pain feels real and your responses feel fresh, and they are fresh, and not to say you need to, you know, torture yourself in order to become a better therapist, but life will do it for you.
That, yes, that it always does. So we've got Ellen on the line now. We've got that connection. Ellen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
My 24-year-old son was diagnosed with testicular cancer in early June. And the gifts that we have seen from this, as difficult as it is that we see my son's maturity, that he's been coping extraordinarily well, and that we have bonded closer as a family. And a very important piece that I read from Thich Nhat Hanh, who I love, that has helped me tremendously personally with it, is that I am able to have my own pain, my emotional pain, and yet still see myself as separate from it enough to function pretty well in my life.
That's a wonderful teaching. Ellen, how's your son doing medically?
Well, he goes to see his oncologist today. I think it looks pretty hopeful. Testicular cancer is more curable than a lot, even though, yeah. But this one had metastasized a little bit, so it's up and down, but the doctor thinks it's pretty promising.
Well,
and he's getting excellent care.
Our thoughts and our wishes are with you and your whole family, Ellen. Thanks for your call. Norman, I want to comment one more time about South Africa and pain. We were on pretty bumpy roads, difficult roads, and I was in a wheelchair van in the back with my daughter. And these bumpy roads, I've got a lot of pain in my arms, and these bumpy roads worsened the pain, and it was pretty bad. And I watched my daughter's face and how she suffered watching her father in pain. And I said to her when we got out, "Honey, I felt pain. You suffered." And there really are two different things. I didn't suffer. I simply felt pain. But she suffered watching her dad and dealing with that helplessness?
Well, I think that's a poignant story and an important distinction. And obviously, you know, just to say what a privilege it is to be on your show, and, you know, very humbling to hear the degree of adversity and the extent to which you have worked with it psychologically is just a wonderful illustration of the very, very thing that I have been writing about and amazed about, is just how the human spirit is capable of so much plasticity and resilience. It's really something, and that's the hopeful message I want to put out, and I think in your program you sort of put it out every week. So thank you.
What has it been like for you? This book came from deep inside your heart. What's it been like launching it?
Well, it's kind of interesting because, you know, historically psychiatrists have been these blank slates. But I think that just like you said, your audience has really healed your shame. My patients, in their courage and in their, you know, just watching them with all the different issues face the world. I remember the first time I wrote about having seasonal affective disorder myself. And at that time, it was really, you know, not frowned upon for a psychiatrist to acknowledge an ailment. But I got so much positive feedback. People thanked me that I was open about it. It reduced their shame. And every time I wrote about anything, they wanted to hear more about my own life. And that encouraged
me. And that changes the relationship and it changes lives. Norman, unfortunately, we are out of time. And Norman Rosenthal's written The Gift of Adversity. Norman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan.
Next week on Voices in the Family, we'll meet Ari Tushman. He's the author of Our Political Nature, The Hidden Roots of Our Deeply Held Values. We'd love to hear from you. We're at whyy.org/voices. Follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And please reach me at drdangottlieb.com, where I'm going to be sharing more of my thoughts about my South Africa trip. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. And Jennifer Lynn is our producer. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Please enjoy your week, my friends.